Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Wednesday. And it's very nice to have you with us. Thank you very much. And we will get started in just a moment and start talking about the news of the day. Before we do that, though, let me introduce our panel to you. We have a great panel, as we always do. Teresa Bourgeois is here. She is a communications consultant and is here with us, as she is most Wednesdays, and we thank her very much for being here.
Delighted to be here day after voting day. And people voted. They did it. They voted.
People voted.
Okay.
People voted.
Democracy's back.
Yes. Was it out of vogue? We'll talk about that in just a second. Well, Jen Smith is here. Hello, Jen.
Hey, good morning, Joe.
She is a reporter for the Berkshire Eagle, and we are thrilled that you are with us once
Thank
again.
You.
Thank you very much. We'll talk about some of the stories you're working on today.
A brilliant reporter for the Berkshire Eagle.
I'll add that to your bio. Put that on your CV, okay?
Sure.
Alan Chartok is here. He is the brilliant.
Now cut it out. Or as Jack Benny would say, cut it out.
Our political observer, our brilliant public reserve.
What's the brilliantest
Stop, more,
now?
Stop,
yes, the
more.
Brilliantest, right, yes.
Cut it out.
More brilliant. Good morning, sir. How are you?
I'm good. I'm reading like crazy, preparing for the interview with Harry Belafonte on Saturday night. And, you know, I know this community is going to turn out to honor this great man at the Egg. In fact, I demand it. It will be at the Egg. Tickets are really going fast. Go to theegg.org get those tickets. And I want to see you there, and I want to say hello to you.
There you go. It's all happening on
November 11th.
November 11th, Saturday night at 11 o'clock. I'm sorry, at 7:30.
It better not be at 11 o'clock.
It's November 11th. That's what got me. November 11th.
It better not be 11
Veterans
o'clock.
No,
I'll be
no.
sleeping.
November 11th. All right.
Veterans Day.
That's right. Absolutely. Okay, let's get started. Let's find out what's happening. We want to talk about election results, because yesterday was the election day, and much of many places had contested races. We're going to there's certainly local stuff to discuss, which our wonderful news department has done such a great job reporting on, as I know Jen's crew over at the Berkshire Eagle has done this as well. And so we're going to focus a little bit this morning on local stuff. Mostly we're going to talk about what happened nationally, especially. Let's begin with the state of Virginia and why that was such an important race. It was closely watched, and it was, I think many pollsters said it was going to be a lot closer than it actually was. And it was a big win for the Democrats. Ralph Northam said a Democrat delivered a victory speech after winning the Virginia governor's race by beating Ed Gillespie, the Republican candidate, and it was quite the race. What do you make of it, Alan?
Well, first of all, I want to issue a public apology, because I said on this air yesterday that I thought Gillespie would win, and because he was only 3 points out at the time, turned out that it was seeming to close in his favor. But the real reason I said it was I was afraid it was going to happen. So I thought if I predicted it, I might ward it off. Don't you see? So that didn't quite work out that way. And when I'm wrong, I'm wrong. And I want to issue an abject apology before you come to take my punditry papers away.
Yes, we take away a brilliant.
One brilliant.
Brilliant.
One brilliant. Down.
Yeah, take it one brilliant. No. So what do we make of this, Teresa? How much can we read into it?
I think the decisiveness of the victory at the top of the ticket is telling, but I think equally important is the number of state delegate seats that the Democrats won, and the diversity of the people who are elected. And the fact that they now will control, I mean, this is going to reverberate for a decade or more in Virginia, because now the Democrats will control the census and redistricting and such. I also think it sends a very strong signal to those who are working on the tax bill right now.
Are you talking specifically about Virginia when you talk about the delegates? What are you
talking about? In Virginia.
Yeah, okay.
So not only did the top of the ticket win, the governor, the lieutenant governor, the attorney general, but they won, the Democrats control the state house. And so that means that they will be in charge during redistricting and the census. They'll be in charge of the census. And I think the other vote, and maybe you were going to get to it, but I think the two telling things that happened last night are the diversity, the breadth of the win there, plus that election in Maine where the proposition to Medicaid, and
remind everybody who might not be on top of that what happened there.
So there was a proposition. They put on the ballot whether or not they would do Medicaid expansion in Maine because the governor had, as many Republican governors have done, they refused to do Medicaid expansion in Maine, and the voters overwhelmingly voted for Medicaid expansion in Maine.
Yeah, so I'm just looking at the Washington Post analysis, and it was a 20-point margin and affects some 70,000 people, low-income folks in Maine.
And in Montana, they elected a mayor who was an immigrant from Liberia, the first African-American, the first black mayor elected in Montana. The number of Democrats, progressive Democrats who won mayor's races, Charlottesville, North Carolina, all over the country, these some amazing local races.
So is there evidence, you think, Teresa, Jen, is there evidence that what has happened here is that this is all anti-Trump? It seems that way to me. You know, that Trump had his shot. He said, I'm going to make everything better. He didn't. He failed within a year. He's made a fool of himself. And this is all reaction.
I think it's a blend of issues. I think there's also, when you look at some of the candidates across the board, I think we have more diversity in candidates who are not just truly left or truly right, but somewhere in the middle of places. You have independent parties that are, you know, changing the game. And I think nationally, and especially here in this region, you see quite a difference in the amount of just grassroots movements, from the Women's March to looking at different bills and referendums, who's going out to sign petitions for those. And I think that really drove, I think there was a movement. There's the constant refrain that people don't vote in local elections. And there was the hashtag of Turnout Tuesday, I think, that was trending for a while about getting local people to the polls. And I think that really affected the results we're seeing this morning.
Okay, so I before we go back to Teresa, I have a question for you that is been interesting to me, and that is that a very small race in our total listening area was in North Adams.
Sure.
We had a mayor who had been basically thrown out of office and who tried to get back in and didn't. He runs for the assembly. For the, what do we call that? The House of Representatives and all.
The first district
yeah,
race.
Right. And he wins overwhelmingly against a very conservative candidate. I think we could say very conservative, but although she did have some, Christine Canning, she did have some things that were not so.
If you talk to her, she often in our interviews with her would refer to herself as more of a moderate, or someone who is more about getting the job done than sticking with, you know, the party.
Well, she had to do that,
framework.
Right?
Sure,
she had to do that because we're taking a look at a tiny little race. Do you think that the Trump factor extends all the way down? Now, remember, this is a guy who's run for office a couple of times since he didn't win, right? And doesn't win. And all of a sudden, he wins overwhelmingly against a conservative. I'm thinking about that. Mm-hmm. And even though, you know, it's not a major race.
I think that it's a number of factors within the North Adams area. You have to look at just the demographics and sort of the issues that are happening within that district. And you do need someone who is experienced, who can get things done. And Barrett is definitely known for getting things done. Whether or not you agree with why and how he's getting those done is another story.
But he's an older guy. Mm-hmm. I should talk. But he's an older guy who runs for political office for an institution which favors younger guys who can be there for a while and get, and when I say guys, I mean men and women, and I'm sorry for making that faux pas. We had at least one letter on that.
I think he was sort of the safe candidate for a lot of people because there was a lot of newer challengers, people who were new to politics. I mean, yeah. Granted, you did have Gail Carides' aide run, so he had some experience. But Stephanie Bosley was a newcomer, young person, didn't have a lot of political experience, although a lot of experience within the community. And I think a lot of people looked at Barrett. He's had obviously longtime supporters within that specific region. Otherwise, he wouldn't have gotten voted to office as much as he did.
But he did get voted out.
He did.
So name recognition counts for a great deal.
I think so. And again, because North Adams and that region have a lot of issues coming down the pipeline from healthcare in the hospital and opioid issues to just infrastructure, aging infrastructure. They had the water scandal earlier this year about some contaminants are not being reported as efficiently as they should. So the district needs a bulldog.
Okay, and back to you, Teresa. I'm so sorry I interrupted you.
I think the other thing is you look at, we talked a lot about a year ago, the did not vote party prevailed. Well, that's what I say all the time. The did not vote party prevailed. And I think this time the voting party prevailed. And I think that's what you were talking about, Jen. Mm. But what's interesting to me is young people voted. 18 to 29-year-olds in Virginia, they went plus 39 for Northam, for the Democratic candidate.
As a pediatric oncologist? Is that what he is? A pediatric surgeon?
Pediatric. Is he I think pediatric surgeon, I thought.
Surgeon,
is he an oncologist?
I think you're right.
If he is,
I'm. But I mean, here young people who are about to have babies and things and voting for, when he accepted, he said, the doctor is in.
Right. Well, I thought that, it's going to take a doctor to heal our differences.
Yeah.
I thought
yeah.
was interesting. I really liked that. And what was interesting to me is the Post is saying that he prevailed white college-educated women, but predominantly people who cared about health care. And all around the country in the local races, that was a consistent.
Interesting.
People came out and voted for health care. And the other thing, I thought the lieutenant governor, what he said... he had an interesting comment, which I know I can't find it. The Fox said that, first of all, they called it a very close race. They didn't cover the elections a lot, but they said that he won with the support of federal government employees and non-white voters.
Meanwhile, in the world of Twitter, Donald Trump. Tweeted yesterday, Ed Gillespie worked hard but did not embrace me or what I stand for. Don't forget, Republicans won 4 out of 4 House seats, and with the economy doing record numbers, we will continue to win even bigger than before. That was at 8:40 last night.
But earlier in the day, his tweet tones were completely different. He was tweeting all about Gillespie and how he was great.
Recorded the robocalls.
Yeah. Well, yeah, no, that's right. How ungracious can a single human being be? I mean, the idea that you support somebody, they don't win, and instead of saying, too bad, I feel bad for you, you say, it's your fault because you didn't embrace me. Unbelievable.
And I will say Gillespie, the Republican in Virginia, was very gracious. And he was very Trumpian in his campaign, particularly in the last 3 weeks.
Yes.
Really, really disgusting campaign. I would call it disgusting racial divides, attacks on immigrants. He didn't bring Trump in, but he used the Trump playbook.
Right. That's correct.
He absolutely used the Trump playbook. And so the Trump playbook was defeated.
Well, this is one of the articles that we were looking at is from an article in The Times, a news analysis of talking about Trumpism without Trump. Mm-hmm. So do you need that guy? And that,
well, the polling
whatever
said
that
don't
is,
bring
let's
him
say
in.
Bravado, mm-hmm.
But they didn't bring him in because the polling said don't bring him in. They brought in Pence, they brought in other people, but their polling said don't bring him in. And even the exit polls showed that he's not popular. But I think the real issue now is, you know, what does this mean for the next elections? But I'm really thinking, what does it mean for the next 3 weeks? Because in the next 3 weeks, the Congress is trying to move this tax bill, and they have to do a budget bill, right, Alan?
Yeah.
I mean, they have to compromise on budget issues.
Yeah. Well, I was a little puzzled by something you just said, which I almost never am because you're so articulate and on target. But you said Gillespie was gracious. You mean in his concession speech?
In his concession speech, yeah. Not in his campaigning.
Well, the campaigning was disgusting,
as
you point out correctly.
He was disgusting in his campaigning, yeah. But he was gracious, and he didn't mention Trump, but he was gracious in his concession speech.
Yeah.
Bill de Blasio won.
Now, if anybody wants to see impartiality in the press, you have got to go look up the Daily News this morning. They hate de Blasio with such a passion that they could barely control their bile. And every story is so weighted against the de Blasio victory or de Blasio's won again, ho-hum, you know, that kind of thing. And we're stuck with them and all of that. You know, the POST, a name I don't like to use, is one thing. But this is the Daily News, and it's just unbelievable how prejudicial this was.
Well, a year ago, we were talking about the chances of this guy ever getting reelected were slim.
Yeah. You were?
We were.
No, I, Joe, the answer is no opponent emerged.
Yeah.
No opponent emerged. The pickings in New York City are in the political class are not really that great. And I'll be darned if I know what it is about de Blasio that gets him all of these votes. Because the newspapers sure don't like him. He's been involved in political scandal after political scandal in which people have been talking about that. So I have to go now because it's time for our break.
Yes, it's time for our break. Thank you, Alan. We'll be right back and continue our conversation panel at WAMC.org. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us, and we appreciate your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. Alan Chartok is here, Jen Smith, and Teresa Bourgeois. We've got some letters. We'll get to those in just a second. I did want a couple races we want to talk about. We didn't get to New Jersey. What do you make about New Jersey?
What do I make about New Jersey?
What do you make of the results from the state of New Jersey?
Well, I don't make much of New Jersey, I'll be honest with you. However...
they have really nice beaches.
And nice people.
And nice people.
My first job was at Rutgers, you know.
My brother and sister-in-law live there.
Nice, a nice state. So what happened here is that is that you have a lieutenant governor...
Yes.
Riding on the basically tail of the governor.
Chris Christie.
Just trying to get out from underneath him.
Okay, if I say the word Chris Christie, what's the first thing that comes into your head? Bridge. Okay, Christie Bridge. Okay, so he didn't get to go to jail like his subordinates did, but he has his numbers are lower than a hound's belly. Last time I looked, it was something like 18%. Can you imagine 18% favorable?
Lower than a hound's belly. Yeah. I like that,
yeah.
Alan.
Yeah,
that's
it's not
a
mine,
good
believe
one.
Me. So, okay, so, you know, she was done for from the very beginning. You know, they tried the Trumpian tricks and all the rest of it, but it wasn't the shocker by any means. It was foregone from the very beginning, I think.
So Phil Murphy.
You get a progressive. He's a Wall Street banker, a former Wall Street banker.
A Goldman Sachs guy.
Another Democrat Goldman Sachs guy.
And he's a newbie. This is first race. So
right.
Here he is.
We'll see what happens.
Right. Yeah.
A lot of business guys think that you can come in and use business principles to run a state or to run a government or a mayoralty. Pardon me. It's not always so, and it's a hard job. So we'll have to watch.
He talked about raising the minimum wage.
A lot of money.
He embraced unions, paid sick leave. I mean, so he didn't run as a, you know, he ran as a Democrat. He didn't run as a Republican, conservative. who was on the Democratic ticket. He ran as a moderate to liberal Democrat.
Then the final thing, and then I want to get to the letters, is as we do our election wrap-up, is the Constitutional Convention in the state of New York went down soundly. I don't know if that was a huge surprise. It was fairly consistent with the polling on this.
Yeah, we were predicting it.
But... Yes. But it did go down, and it certainly and many think it brought a lot of people out too.
I don't know. You know, I'm very involved in this, in that I wasn't for it. That's for sure. I've written a lot of columns about it, but I can tell you that my friend Jerry Benjamin, who I have immense respect for at New Paltz, was sort of the major leader or a major leader, you know, in this. And when he speaks, a lot of people listen. He shows up on the front page of the New York Times all the time as a commentator. And I just feel bad for him and for people like Hank DeLay and some of the other people who surrounded him. But the people didn't believe that the same pals who were screwing it all up in the legislature were not going to be the same people who were controlling the Constitutional Convention. Some of them would run for office themselves and get paid twice. They get a full salary as a legislator and a full salary as a constitutional.
Or the big money, you know, Mercer money, big money special interests would just control it.
Well, that's right.
I mean, that's the thing that was my fear.
No, I hear you. And yet... You know, the political, the one thing that would have, I live in Massachusetts, I didn't get to vote, but the one thing that would have made me vote for it is that Boss Hastie, the Speaker of the Assembly, and Flanagan, the Majority Leader in the Senate, were all against it. And if they're against it, I think we should probably be for it.
No, I was against it. Get focused on the census. That's what I say.
Yeah.
Get focused on the
yes,
census.
Yes, you have all said that many times.
Over, I know, I'm a broken record, but all of that energy that you wanted to focus on a constitutional convention, focus it on getting the census right. Because the Trump team is really, you know, they've underfunded, understaffed the census. It's really important. It will have a generational effect if we don't get this right.
And you feel specifically about New York State in that? Because after all, that's what
well,
you're
saying. Well, any state. I think well, that people saying... in Vermont should focus yeah. on it in Vermont.
Oh,
people
sure.
in people in Massachusetts, you know, in our Connecticut, all of the listening area, whatever state you're in.
Pennsylvania, Detroit.
Pennsylvania, everybody. Mm-hmm.
I think that'll also bring out another sort of grassroots.
No, because those are the places where Trump won. So if you have a...
Oh, I thought we had listeners in Detroit.
Yeah, I didn't know. Suddenly we were going from a state to a city. So
well,
I got you now.
No, I did, yes.
No, I got
right.
you.
No, but you're right, though. It could have...
I thought
a big
I was missing something. I'm sorry.
But, Alan, you're absolutely right, though. Even
thanks,
if we don't have listeners there, if you get the census wrong, and if you shortchange places like Detroit and Flint... And Grand, well, not Grand Rapids so much, but you can really change the nature of
especially
things.
Especially the big cities.
The big cities.
That's why I said Detroit, Joe.
Right.
And didn't name the state. I know what state it's
Ohio.
In.
No, I know. I thought you were making another reference, actually.
Oh, really?
Like a Nathan Detroit reference.
Oh.
But I didn't know. But I got
you. Get down, get down. You're rocking the boat.
Yeah, yeah,
oh,
yeah.
My gosh. You guys are going way past me. This is an entertainer. I don't
okay.
So, but... the other thing, back to the vote in general, I thought the other thing about the exit polls is that they were saying that only, you know, the big talk for the Republicans is taxes, taxes, taxes. Only 1 in 7 people said in an exit poll said taxes was their key issue. And the same number said immigration. But 4 in 10 said health care.
That's incredible.
This is an election on health care.
Mm-hmm.
People are very concerned about health care. So again...
It was about to be taken away from them.
I bet, you know, all this talk in the last few days, that, you know, the Republicans are having a lot of trouble in the House and the Senate with their tax bill because they can't figure out how to pay for it. All the scoring is coming out, you know, it doesn't work for them, violates the Byrd rule, can't bring it. Anyway, so they need more money, and they were focused on possibly changing the
healthcare mandate. So what's your prediction? What is your prediction on the health, on the budget bill? Excuse me, on the tax bill? Do they get one or not?
I think this election... changes the conversation immediately about the tax bill.
Well, yes, but yes or no? Do they get one or not? I demand an answer.
Okay, but then we really have to get to letters because I want to eat the spinach so we can go to the chocolate cake, which is talking about the Berkshire Museum.
Okay, so your answer is, Teresa, there will be a tax bill or there won't?
Not this year.
There will be, I say.
This year?
Yeah, and that's because I don't think Trump gives a damn, Scarlett, about what's in that bill. I think he just wants a bill, and he'll make any compromise he has to get a bill.
You already have a leading Republican announce that he's not running for re-election in the House, New Jersey Republican. I mean, these people are they're not going to stick with this.
Okay. Just remember what I said and when I said it.
Mark the tape, ladies and gentlemen. Let's go to letters.
Okay, here. Daisy, great letter writer, Daisy. I just want to note that a moderate Republican won in Virginia. He attracted independents, and that says a lot going toward presidential. Dems, take note. Great day.
Indeed. I think that's very important.
And which moderate Republican, just to remind everybody, was that?
The governor.
A moderate Republican.
Oh, Democrat.
It says here, a moderate Republican won in Virginia. That's what it says from Daisy. Maybe she...
Oh, I think she means a moderate Democrat.
Yeah. Okay. Gotcha.
Danica Room,
Oh, she's not moderate.
No.
And Kathy says, Virginia House of Delegates... hi, guys. I think that Teresa is mistaken, but I hope not. I think the Dems picked up many delegates, but not enough to control the House of Delegates. Am I mistaken?
I thought late at night they said they did. They needed 18 seats, and I thought they got 19 or 20, but I'll double check.
Okay. And Jay Scott, the wins are great, but I'm afraid I'm most proud of the two women who ran on the Democratic ticket for town-level positions here in Little Greenfield in northern Saratoga County, the first local Democratic candidates I've seen in my 6 years of living and voting here. Is there evidence that more of this is happening elsewhere, even if they didn't win this time? Darn if I know. Okay, and then from Charisse, could you be reading too far into the candidates? I think many went in and voted for anything but Republican as anti-Trump statement. I agree with that, by the way. I think the average person knows and researches way less about candidates than you assume. And I assume, Charisse, you're talking directly to our brilliant panel here, particularly Teresa, who does go way into the weeds at looking at all this stuff.
I'm embarrassed to say I was looking up the House of Delegates, so I didn't hear what the letter said.
Well,
did it say I said something wrong? I'm sorry.
People have impressions when they go to vote, which is, I'm voting Democratic because the Republicans are horrible this year, or Trump's horrible, as opposed to your brilliance. And when you bring up, when in the exit polls, 4 out of 10 or 7 out of 10 were concerned with health care, and 1 out of 10 was concerned with this or that. Don't you see?
Yeah, I mean, I think people go because generally they care about some issue. That's what motivates them to go. Something's bothering them. Something's upsetting them. I think that they don't go thinking that if I vote this way, I can change the tax conversation in the next 2 weeks. That's me being down in the weeds. Mm-hmm. I do think that these results, these exit polls, this data that shows young people voted in record numbers, people in the suburbs voted Democrat, not Republican.
Astorino goes down in Westchester County, he was going to be the candidate against Cuomo.
Even though he got all that Mercer money. And I think that it does send signals to the people who are writing these tax bills and who are putting together this budget bill.
And if not, it should.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we will talk about the Berkshire Museum and other topics. We welcome your letters panel at WAMC.org. Alan Chartok, Jen Smith, and Teresa Bourgeois. We'll be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and our panel discussion this morning. Bela Fleck playing this morning, and Abigail Washburn. They'll be at the Mahawi in Great Barrington this Sunday, the 12th of November. And you can find out more by going to mahawi.org. Mahawi.org.
And some people think Bela Fleck is the best banjo player in America or the world.
There you go. Let's talk about the Berkshire Eagle and your story today. This was all going down to the Berkshire Museum The Berkshire Museum had a victory yesterday in court. Judge ruled on Tuesday that it could go ahead with plans to sell off artworks, including two Norman Rockwell paintings, as part of its plan to fund its new vision. The judge ruled that plaintiffs in two civil actions and the state attorney general's office itself failed to make their cases to halt a large-scale deaccession by the museum. The judge is unsparing in his view that the attorney general's office conducted an anemic review of the art sale after it was notified about it by the museum in June. Okay, where do we begin?
So I think
it's over then, right? I mean, the as of the 13th, they will be sold. Yes.
Right. Yeah. So just a mere few days. That's the case. Earlier, the attorney general had also put a limit on what the quantity of pieces that can be sold. Judge Agostini said that doesn't really matter anymore. So, you know, ultimately it will come down to how Sotheby's does its job, which is to attempt to sell 40 artworks. While this case is being decided, they didn't stop what they were doing in their auction house and kept moving forward. So that's one case in point. I think there's going to be analysis, obviously, from Attorney General Moore Healey's office. I don't think they're going to not look at the whole 25 pages of what Judge Agostini wrote on his deliberations. Whether the next few days is enough time for them to put in any sort of appeal, it doesn't look very promising. But who knows? We'll stay tuned to see what happens there. You know, from a journalist standpoint, I'm really curious what this means from all the momentum that this case got, right? So in the museum's 100 plus year history, currently it has 2,000 paid members, some new trustees, some returning trustees that got revoted to the board. Meanwhile, you have the Save the Art group that has amassed 2,000 Facebook members and about $20,000 in sort of funds to promote its cause. So what does that all mean for the community and for support for this institution that hopefully will still exist in the short term? And you know, what is this board's responsibility in the long term? What sort of lessons will this board and the community take away from this case in terms of facing? I think Agostini sort of summed up his viewpoint too of calling deaccessioning an evil, necessary evil of what's facing museums these days, in terms of getting hit by the economy and also not having enough support and funds to do what it does. I think that question's going to be looked at.
And what about the future, Jen, for all of those people who are just furious about this? What happens to the museum as a result of that?
I think you have to look at whether these groups can come to terms with each other. I mean, both of them obviously have the common interest of having a museum in the heart of the Berkshires that is a valuable place to go, that has collections of note, that becomes a destination for people. What will they do to support each other's best interest? Will the board do more to reach out to folks to let community have its say, despite not being it's not a public institution?
Well, what do you mean let? Though, they didn't let anything happen. In fact, they were furious about it, I think.
In terms of?
Well, I got a letter from somebody on that board who just said, I want to kill the museum because of my columns, you know, on the matter. So I don't think they have a choice about letting people speak out.
No. I think it depends on what their processes are. I mean, every day the museum is open to the public and they have special events. You know, will their next big event is the Festival of Trees that comes up, and you know, will attendance be affected by all this? Will people, the 2,000 people who were part of the Save the Art group, not support this longstanding community event, or will they show up and maybe just have a cocktail, look at the trees, and talk about what are the next steps?
What if they sell the trees first?
Yeah.
Just a joke, sorry.
Yeah.
You went there, Joe, didn't you?
Sorry. Just cheap shot. I apologize.
I wanted to respond to this. I think basically... I am deeply, deeply disappointed in this decision.
And I don't think we were talking. I think Joe brought up the CBS article today about the clincher ending with the difference of valuing treasure versus money.
Right.
Right. And what did that say to you,
people that
Joe?
Don't know that CBS did a piece.
CBS
sure.
News
and
their kicker story, and basically said, you know, will this community find out that cash is more important than treasure. I think that's the story. And of course, the larger story, too, that you all have been covering so beautifully, but the trade publications in the art world of the ramifications of what this means for other museums of similar size, but even also major museums are looking to sell works of art, of what that means is I think that's going to have a lot of ripple effect as well.
Well, look, they're selling their children as far as I'm concerned. They have these, this is going to end up probably somebody on a phone from somewhere we don't know about and during the auction, and it may well end up, if there are enough of them left after all of these arrests, in a Saudi Arabian prince's basement somewhere, which we'll never know about. To me, this is so sick. They didn't need the money tomorrow. They could have mobilized in a way that other not-for-profits do and do very successfully. People like the Rockwell Museum themselves and others. The Rockwell children were opposed to this thing. They knew what the father wanted. This just seems to me to be, it may have been legal. And while we're on the subject of legal, and here I have to really be careful of my words. There is a political class in Pittsfield that has supported this sale, which is beyond anything I understand. We have a state senator. We have a former mayor who I've always respected. We have a lot of people who said this is the right thing to do. And I don't know why they did that. I don't know. I do know that judges, here we go, the judges are people who are political themselves. They make decisions based on law, no question about it, and it may well be that the law, Agostini was right about the law here. On the other hand, there's a political class, I don't know who belongs to that political class, and whether or not, you know, that becomes telling in what one judge has to say about all of this. Now, I don't want to be unkind about it, but I am, you know, I'm always thinking.
I think that's what you're going to see come out of the next steps of the AG's office is looking at this decision from this particular judge. And you basically have two legal teams sort of going at it in terms of looking at case study and definitions and precedents
sure.
and deaccessioning. And I've said it before, I think this will go down in history as a massive case study for the rest of the art and trade world.
Yes.
And I haven't been following it nearly as closely, obviously. And so if somebody is going to give a gift in the future, do they just are more specific?
Sure.
I think if it will give anyone pause to make these considerations. As a board, I don't know how trained or versed board members are in...
Sure.
When they're making these, and I think that's very interesting because any institution in the Berkshires, in the Albany area, in Connecticut, Vermont, are all going to face this issue of how to be sustainable.
Well,
and how and what
you raise money
and what. But how? And
what
I
do you
think
mean how? How do we do it? How do
yeah.
somebody
I mean,
say,
the
well,
Berkshire.
You have a radio station. Okay, forget about
but
us.
But in the Berkshires.
But how about the Rockwell? How about Jacob's Pillow?
Tanglewood.
How about Tanglewood? They make tons of money.
And I think that's what this new iteration, new incarnation of the board with its new members and returning members will have to have a discussion about in terms of they had, if they had financial trouble coming down the pipeline, if they knew 5 years ago that this was going to be something they're going to have to face, how do they go about planning for that?
How do you get capital?
If you're gonna, if you need capital, how do you run?
Who's
that
the chair
campaign?
Of their committee?
It's Carol Bosco.
But when you put people on your board, when they put people on their board, are they putting people who are dissonant with their philosophy, or are they going to find new people who, they're not putting new people on who are going to come on and raise hell. They're finding people, I suspect, who are going to be with them on all
but
of
that's
this.
But that's now, not unusual. People always build their
boards. Of course not. And so I have great respect for... you know, for people who serve and how they serve. But on the other hand, I want to make sure that this thing, which is so appalling to me, I mean, it just makes no sense to me whatsoever. And I want to compliment the Berkshire Eagle because when the plan was announced, the Berkshire Eagle wrote a very strong editorial in support of this plan. But they took a look at it, and they had the courage and the decency to change their mind. And they said, well, we didn't know about all of this. And I don't know whether they were led by all the people who were very angry about it or whether they just did it out of intellect. I think it was the right and courageous thing to do.
And it's a great matter. It brings up a great matter of transparency, especially when you're dealing with something that's accessed and has long been supported by the public, even though, again, it's not technically a public institution. But, you know, people have lent their support there. But in the Berkshires, we have this history of boards making a lot of poor and troubling decisions. Look at North Adams Regional Hospital case and what that board did or did not do in that instance. And I think that's sort of part of the bigger picture, too, when you're having conversations of what a due diligence of a board is and what its members do or do not support and how they relay that to the public that they serve.
We are at the top of the hour. We're going to go to news and get an update from Ray Graff, including election results and much more. When we come back, we'll talk more about this. We'll have a lot of letters as well. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. panel@wamc.org. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. 7 minutes past 10 o'clock. Alan Chartok, Jen Smith, and Teresa Bourgeois with us this morning. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. We'll go to those in just a second. So when it comes to the sale of these items, Jen, just because we've been talking a lot about the Rockwells, but sure. So there were some items that were removed from sale, and we don't know what. Is that temporary, permanent? How is that going to work out?
You know, I think that's something we have to fact check and follow up on based on the new decision of what the actual intentions of items to be deaccessioned will be on the 13th.
I don't think...
There are some Calders. There are... I'm trying to think of some other... I would say the Rockwells and the Calders are among the
biggies.
The biggies, because they've just been associated with the museum for so long.
Yeah.
So now the only hope, based on no fact, but the only hope is that somebody buys it and then lends it back to the museum.
Right. I know that's always a possibility. It's interesting. I was pulling up a statement from... the Association of Art Museum Directors, and they say their hope is that there are going to be clear limitations on the use of funds from the deaccessioned works, and these limitations prohibit the use of these funds for operating costs, capital expenses, or general endowments, which is interesting because that's what the point of this sale is. So I'm curious to see what role that group will have. The AAM and the AMD say we will continue to seek out appropriate opportunities to make this case with respect to the Berkshire Museum's plans, and we stand ready to assist it and other museums facing financial difficulties to avoid resorting to sale of collections as a remedy. How do you do that?
At the risk of prolonging this conversation and just for a random question that I have in the back of my mind, but given that they had these artworks, but especially the Rockwells, that they used so infrequently, meaning they showed them, the showing right now, the exhibition that's taking place at Sotheby's in New York City, where people, the general public, actually has a chance to see these two works, is really the first time they've seen the light of day in a decade and a half, right?
For the wider public, I mean, so the museum had this whole initiative a few years back to go into its vaults and pull out things that hadn't been shown in a while. So they created a space within the museum where you could walk through and you saw everything from skeletons that you hadn't seen in a while, from its mammal and
real-life
things that you haven't seen in a while, to the Rockwells. And they were all sort of together in this one room. They have a replica of the Nike and things like
so
that.
So they had not been displaying their Rockwells?
No, they hadn't.
Not
been
on
displayed.
A consistent basis.
Right. But I want to say,
but I don't think that's rare for any museum. Even the Rockwell Museum doesn't display all of its Rockwells at once, right? So that is not anything new.
Okay, I find it interesting though that especially in the Shovelton's Barbershop, that it's one of the most iconic Norman Rockwell paintings, and you would think that if you're a museum who is, I don't know, let's say cash-strapped, that you would put it on display.
Unless, of course, you had a plan otherwise.
Well, you were a museum in the Berkshires with, you know, with Rockwell.
I don't know. I just find that interesting. Okay, we have letters.
Okay, we do. Bias, says Stacy. Leave it to Alan to call into question the judge's impartiality, integrity, and character by implying he made his decision based on something other than the law without any basis to do so. In fact, I specifically said, you know, I thought that the law he had the law there. Obviously, Alan is doing so simply because he doesn't like the decision. A, you're right. I don't like the decision. And I don't think it makes sense. And all I talked about was judges who are part of a political class, and that the rest of that political class, inexplicably to me, it was for this, or a lot of them were. So I just couldn't quite get that. Do I believe there are members of the Supreme Court of the United States who, based on their character and their political orientation, do things? Yes, Stacy. So that's it. And David says, it's interesting that the Mount, which was near bankruptcy a few years ago, just had its biggest year yet and seems on a path to future growth. Maybe the Berkshire Museum could take a lesson. And that's from David, okay? And then Anthony says, good morning, panel. Trump-free show so far. Thank you. Actually, we did talk about Trump a good deal in the very beginning when we talked about the election results, right?
But we were getting a compliment, we'll take it.
We'll take any compliment. Okay. Megan says, the museum looked to sell their art before making tough salary cuts that every nonprofit struggling to survive has to make. The museum has a highly paid CEO, CFO, and executive director on their staff. The job of the museum is the care of its collection. Cut the fat before cutting the art. Let me say, whatever. All the projections show that before they get into real fiscal trouble, it'll take 8 years. So you had a lot of time to do something between now and then. Did you want to say something, Jen? No,
no, I think it's a valid point that that's something we still need to examine, is the timeline and the immediacy of this all, and how any profits that are made from these sales will actually be allocated, put to use. I think it's important to look at.
The Berkshire Museum says, Grace, our friend Grace from Sheffield, if they sell paintings that were given to them, wouldn't they have to pay capital gains on the wholesale price? I don't see why. You know, it's a not-for-profit institution. Why would you pay? We need somebody who knows more than we do.
But I would probably think, a listener. I bet there's a listener who can.
Yeah, I would think. I would think as a not-for-profit institution, probably not. But
I'm also assuming that they figured that out before they. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
It would seem like they had that worked out, but I don't know.
Okay, and Rockwell's,
that's a good point.
Jill says on the Rockwells, can the Rockwell children buy back their father's work, or if necessary, bid on it to buy it back if the auction occurs? Wait a second. It was their father who gave them to the museum. So That would mean the Rockwells would have bought them twice or given them twice. You think about that? Anyway, Rosemary says, election. Voting in my area of Sullivan County was very frustrating. Almost all candidates ran unopposed, running as representatives of several parties at once. How can a candidate hold sincere platforms reflecting the conflicting ideals of half a dozen parties? And how can a party embrace somebody who's running on all tickets? The only thing of value in my voting were the statewide issues on the ballot.
Well, to that, I mean, I'm not sure about in Sullivan County, but I have read over and over again the number of people who ran in places where there had only been one candidate because they felt that there was, you know, no chance of winning. They did have new candidates get in at the local level. And this is one of the things that the DNC and all these different organizations are doing, is trying to get people to get into very local races and get engaged. And it seems to be working.
Mario says, question, does the panel believe that this election heralds Democratic control of Congress next year? It's a very interesting question.
I think it's too soon to tell.
Things can change in a year. Look what's happened in this year.
Things can change in a month. I think the immediate...
More so than ever.
I think the immediate impact. I mean, just think about a year ago today, what we were... Tonight, what we were doing. But...
Andrew says, de Blasio won because of pre-K. I'm surprised that the women on the panel didn't pick up on this. Poor and middle-class women in New York City received an astonishing benefit from de Blasio's follow-through on a campaign promise. Remember, 50% of New York City residents are at or near the poverty level, and 40% speak a language other than English at home. Pre-K is American, one of the few successes in the Trump era. Please read beyond the headlines.
So I haven't focused that much on the de Blasio race, I'll admit, but I will say that pre-K is not just a women's issue. Pre-K is a parents' issue. Pre-K
certainly
is.
Absolutely.
Pre-K is an employer's issue. I think
it's a social and workforce development issue.
Right.
An Allen issue.
Pre-K is critical, and that we should all, not just women, but everybody should be focused on it. And I did not realize that. Sorry about that. But I will say pre-K is an issue that it's gender neutral. Everybody should be concerned about it.
Prop 2 and Skelos and Silver, when these two thieves, I would take some issue with that. They are not convicted. Well, they're convicted, but they are. Their appeal seems is happening, are retried, and if found guilty, won't Prop 2 then apply to them? No. Please discuss. What a great discussion this morning. As always, that's from Cynthia in Niskayuna. No, the fact of the matter is, I think all of the reports are that it would apply to people from now on.
Yeah, I mean, you can't do retroactive. Yeah, right. I do want to correct, thank you for one of the letter writers about the, I was over-enthusiastic about the Virginia House of Delegates because I looked quickly and it was 48-47 Democrats, and I should have done the math. It's because there are 5 seats yet to be determined. And so the writer who earlier said that the Democrats had not yet won the House of Delegates, that's correct. And I
will hold ourselves accountable.
I regret my error. I was overly enthusiastic when I read the chart. I didn't read the asterisks. I should have realized that, but thank you.
All right, let's talk about North Korea for a moment. We have just about 5 minutes left of the program. Talk about North Korea and talk about what the president had to say last night in a hardline speech. He warned North Korea, do not underestimate us. The president on Wednesday warned against the threat posed by a country ruled by a cult in a hardline speech aimed at rallying international pressure against North Korea over its escalating nuclear weapons program. Trump, in an address to South Korea's National Assembly, said the rogue regime was putting itself at risk by continuing to pursue its nuclear ambitions and test ballistic missiles. The weapons you are acquiring are not making you safer, Trump said, directing his remarks at North Korea. They're putting your regime in grave danger. Every step you take down this dark path increases the peril you face.
Well, you know, look, I guess it's indisputable that I don't like Trump and I don't like what he's done in this country. He's putting a hard face on it. I think the risk, the great risk, is that by threatening them, he may increase the chances that they'll do something really stupid. And that is one of the things that a lot of people are concerned about, not least of whom are the Chinese. Because if this thing explodes, it's going to be on Trump's plate, and because he keeps threatening them, and of course Kim keeps coming back with even worse rhetoric than Trump is using on him. So so you know, it's a very dangerous situation. Clearly, Trump went to went on this Asian trip because you know, he needs it. He really needs it. I think, frankly, the guy has been pretty much sticking to the script. I don't think he's been doing that much, especially vis-a-vis Korea, that would put him, you know, at the sort of Twitter risk that he makes every time he comments on a domestic situation.
Well, I think there are multiple things happening with this issue. One, obviously, there's nuclear weapons involved. And anytime you have dangerous rhetoric happening around the use of nuclear weapons, it's a dangerous situation. You need to be careful with what's being said, who you inflame, and what they could do in retaliation. At the other hand, if you look deeper into some of the things that are being talked about, if you looked at Trump's rhetoric on this issue, he brought up a lot of human rights issues, which is something that's not being addressed. And it's something that's troubling, too, as you look at what's happening as a whole across the Asian diaspora. You have a huge amount of human rights issues that are happening there. You have a huge amount of environmental issues that are happening there. And if you tie in what's going on now with the Paris Accords and other environmental issues, you have China that sort of poised itself to take leadership on you know, making environmental outcomes. Meanwhile, in Delhi this morning, the smog was so bad. They're shutting down schools and businesses. And, you know, that's a big issue. And that wasn't really talked about when Tillerson visited recently. So I think there are also bigger issues at play when it comes to what our administration is doing over in Asia. But I think when it comes to specifically North Korea and what's happening with nuclear weapons, it's very dangerous ground right now.
Teresa?
I think Trump was, some of the experts applauded him for not using words like little rocket man and talking about fire and fury. But two things that I'm watching for is, how are the Chinese going to react to the militarization of Japan? I think that all of his weapons talk about selling those weapons in Japan. And I also think at the same time that he's in this trip in Asia, you have what's going on in Saudi Arabia, which is really stunning. You have them consolidating their power internally, and you have them blockading Yemen. And you think about what they've done recently in the last couple of months with Qatar and blockading Qatar, and now blockading Yemen, and with apparently, you know, U.S. selling them arms and helping them do so, and maybe with a blink and a nod. So the Chinese, they look at the whole world. And so as the American leadership goes and asks the Chinese to be tough on North Korea, you know, how do we do that in the face of other things going on in the world? I think this is a very complex chess game. And I don't know if certainly he's not a chess master, and Xi Jinping is. And so we'll see what the outcome is.
All right. Let's pause there, and we'll conclude our conversation for this morning. Just a reminder that Harry Belafonte will be at the Egg on Saturday night.
The 11th.
On the 11th, November 11th. And you can find out more information by going to theegg.org, theegg.org.
I sure hope everybody will come. We really owe it to Harry to honor him. And this is a good way of doing it. I'd love to see you all in the audience. I'd love to talk to you. And I really hope you'll do it. He's a great man. He's a part of our history. And we need to do this.
Theegg.org. Alan Chartok, Jen Smith, Teresa Bourgeois, thank you very much for being with us. And thank you for writing in this morning. We'll be back with more program right after this.